Brad and Rudy Purpose calls the National Guard with guns.
Okay, we don't have a quorum yet.
Okay, it is in there. Okay.
But we're going to go ahead and get the meeting started and get some of the things taken care of. And staff will inform us as soon as we do have a quorum present. And Representative Schumacher, is your first bill going to be the 2525?
Sure, Madam Chair, that sounds good.
It's on the list, so I just wanted to. Since you're here and it's on the list, I'm thinking that must be the case. We do have a quorum now, and I'll officially call the meeting to order. And as a matter of process, I'd like to take care of the minutes from the last meeting.
So moved, Madam Chair.
So moved. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll proceed to a vote. All those in favor of the minutes, say aye. Say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much.
Say hi. That's
okay. Hi. At any rate, Representative Schumacher, we are ready for business. And if you would, again, for the tape record, state your name and so on, and bill number for the taped record, and make sure that your testifiers, when it comes time before they speak first, that if they would do the same as well.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Representative Joe Schumacher. This is House File 2525, and I believe the motion for this is going to be to hear it today and then to lay it over to be brought back up.
That is correct, Representative Schumacher.
All right, and so that's the motion I would make on this. House File 2525 provides a nursing home rate increase for health information technology costs and grants to certain elderly waiver providers for HIT costs. The amount currently in the bill is $6 million for nursing facilities and $1 million for assisted living facilities. At this time, I would like to move the A1 amendment to the bill.
Representative Schumacher moves the A1 amendment to House File 2525. If you'd please explain your amendment, Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment sets the expenditures to be incurred between October of last year and January 1st of 2016, as well as allowing unused appropriations to be carried over to the next year.
Okay, we have the A1 amendment from Representative Schumacher. Any member questions or discussion? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Motion prevails. A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Schumacher, back to your bill and as amended.
All right. Thank you, members. The goal of this bill is to help nursing facilities and assisted living settings move towards the electronic health record adaptation in their use, their interoperability, and in e-prescribing. What we're trying to do with these funds, what we're aiming towards, is improving the patient health and safety, reducing healthcare system costs, reducing errors, and producing savings for the consumer, the healthcare system, and the state programs and providers under this section. There is a letter from one of my constituents in the packet that describes their process and what they went through on a cost and just a facility-wise in the city of Pipestone for some of the changes that they saw with their electronic records. And with that, I would ask that Dale Shreve and Todd Bergstrom from the Long Term Care Imperative offer their testimony.
Well, welcome to the committee. And again, for your for the record, tape record, please state your name and title.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dale Shreve. I'm Vice President for Health Policy with Aging Services of Minnesota. And I want to thank members of the committee for this opportunity to discuss House File 25. Together, our organization and Care Providers of Minnesota constitute the, for advocacy purposes, the Long-Term Care Imperative. This bill provides two types of funding. For the rate years from October 1, 2013, and October 1, 2014, that would be ending September 30th, 2015, nursing facilities would apply to access funding and would be reimbursed through the facility rates on a percentage of cost basis. That's for the nursing facilities. There will also be a $1 million grant fund to be administered by the Commissioner of Health for provider organizations that participate in the Elderly Waiver Customized or 24-Hour Customized Living Programs. Currently, about two-thirds of Minnesota's nursing homes have some sort of electronic health records, but these homes typically face barriers that prevent them from exchanging health information with other health parties, whether it's hospitals, other nursing homes, home care agencies, assisted living programs, pharmacies, or laboratories. Less than one-sixth of these facilities can send electronic records, and less than one-fourth can receive records electronically from the providers that I've mentioned. This was from a survey done by the Department of Health on electronic health records that was just published in February of this year.
Thank you, Daryl. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Bergstrom, and I am the Director of Research and Payment for Care Providers in Minnesota, and testifying on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative on House File 2525, which, as Daryl mentioned, provides funding through a series of rate increases for nursing homes to adopt and utilize, and as well as begin to interoperable exchange of health care records. This will improve resident safety and health, reduce errors, reduce admissions to hospitals, and thereby reduce costs to the healthcare system at large. It's intended to provide assistance to nursing homes regardless of where they are on the journey from paper records to electronic health records. The proposal, the way we've modeled it, is similar to the sprinkler funding that was used to help nursing homes meet the mandate regarding sprinklering their facilities. And by doing so, what it really does is it only guarantees a percentage of the actual cost. So in theory, nursing facilities will have to put forth some effort as well in terms of resources. House File 2525 also provides a grant program for assisted living projects that participate in the Elderly Waiver Customized Living or 24-Hour Customized Living program. And that also is intended, it's geared towards providing more resources to those establishments that are serving more Medicaid clients. We believe these activities will enable nursing facilities and assisted living establishments to join the health information technology efforts, which will again generate cost savings, create gains and efficiencies, and improve patient outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bergstrom. Representative Schumacher, otherwise we do have a... Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. And Representative Schumacher, to your witnesses, it looks to me just that you're using two different mechanisms for funding this. In the nursing facilities, you're looking at an ongoing rate adjustment, and for providers of customized living services, you're looking at a one-time grant. And I think we've handled it in other ways in the actual healthcare provider. We have like a revolving loan program. We have, you know, grants for certain types of medical clinics. And could you just explain why you chose to do a couple of different approaches for an industry that's serving a similar population, and whether or not you looked at some of the other models we've used with the healthcare clinics? It just seems like it might be easier if we kind of treated them all in the same way, whatever that is.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Loeffler. Actually, that's part of the reason why we're laying this over today to be brought up next week, that we have been looking at further options with that to provide some things that may even make this so it's a cost-neutral bill, so we can move forward with some of the grants that are already in place and make it so that we can actually get this going this year without needing an extra allocation to that. Is there anything else? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Shreve.
Thank you. The other consideration is that, frankly, for assisted living, their evolution in this healthcare record technology is somewhat lags behind where nursing facilities are at. And a grant program, frankly, probably should be viewed more as piloting or seeding efforts, whereas nursing facilities have come a long ways, say, in the last 5 years. And so there's probably, and given some of the cost issues, we chose to go with a kind of a rate reimbursement formula.
Okay, Representative Loeffler, or is there somebody else who wants to address it?
Continuing to explore options. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And I also wanted to add that in my history here, we did find money for the Hoyer Lift bill that the nursing homes did eat up. It was $1 million, I think, and they got it fast. And I got that out of deed. So I'd be happy to work with you and with them looking for some other additional funds.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Fritz. All right. Members, any other questions? Okay. Well, let's go ahead to vote. I know you have other bills, Representative Schumacher. This is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. All right. So that's, it'll be laid over for possible inclusion, or is there something else? All right.
All right.
And this is Schumacher Day in HHS Finance, so just get to stay right there, and we'll go ahead into your next bill, which I have is House File 2716. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 2716 establishes an ongoing appropriation of $1.5 million for nursing facility moratorium exception projects. And at this time, I would like to move the A1 amendment to this bill.
A1 amendment has been moved. Representative Schumacher, to your amendment.
This amendment, Madam Chair and members, would include moratorium exception projects that were completed after August 30th of 2010 and establishes an effective date.
All right. Members, any questions on the A1 amendment to House File 2716? Seeing none, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Schumacher, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Currently, there is a moratorium on the licensure for Medicaid certification and construction projects that exceed $1.4 million. The Commissioner of Health can grant exceptions if we as a legislature authorize funds. This bill would authorize an ongoing $1.5 million in funding for these projects. This is intended to help facilities that need significantly update or even replace their buildings in an effort to prepare to serve our growing senior population. Seated with me are Jeff Bostick from Aging Services of Minnesota and Ted Birdstrain from Care Providers of Minnesota to provide additional testimony for this.
Okay, which one of you will go first, Mr. Bostick?
Thanks, Madam Chair. This is my name is Jeff Bostick with Aging mm-hmm. Services of Minnesota, and we're here to support the bill funding moratorium exceptions projects that Representative Schumacher has brought forward. We think this is one of those bills that has a great return on a relatively small investment for the state. The investment in the physical places where older adults are served is much needed, and the state portion of the cost is relatively small. And we haven't had funding for a little while. The last time we did a round of funding was for projects in 2009. There were 11 projects. The state spent a fairly similar amount to what they're spending now, about just under $1.5 million in state funding. Funded over $157 million in total construction projects. So we believe that if we could get another $1.5 million to go into this competitive process for people to apply to do projects to update or replace nursing facilities, that we'd see a similar impact this time around. And it benefits facilities from throughout the state. Last time, of the 11 that were selected, there were about half were in the metro area, about half were not, including cities around the state like Hutchinson, International Falls, Grand Rapids, Sartell, and Albany. And looking at the financial impact of the investment, $1.5 million in state funding. Provides almost 2,500 jobs, $311 million in total economic activity, $99 million in additional wages, and $9 million in additional tax revenue. So,
thank you, Mr. Bostick. I have one question for you, and I think you stated this number. I just want to be clear again.
Okay.
What you're saying is that $1.5 million in this additional funding results in $157 million in projects. That would be about a little less than 1% of those overall costs of those projects would come from state funding?
Yes, just to be clear about how that works, the $1.5 million is a one-year funding from the state, and it does go into the base. So if you analyze it over time, the state is paying more than 1%. But from a short-term perspective, in the next few years, we can do almost $160 million in construction projects for a $1.5 million annual investment in state funds.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Bostic, that's in addition to the ongoing built into the base money as well, correct?
Well.
All right.
Yeah, the 1.5 million gets built into the base, so it's paid out annually to that amount. It's a limit on how much additional funding can go into the base, into the annual base, if that makes sense.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Bostic. Members, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Bostic. That's the capital reimbursement. Can this also lead to other rate increases, like you have more single bedrooms, so you get more people paying with the single bed rate, and you can add enhanced services? And I mean, I'm just trying to figure out if there's additional operating costs beyond that $1.5 million.
And DHS can speak to that. There should not be. I see that there's not a fiscal note on this bill, or at least I haven't seen one. In the past, the fiscal note has just been for the capital piece. Mm-hmm. There is no direct impact on operating, as you point out. You know, there's some changes potentially because likely there will be more single rooms after this, so there could be some additional incentives paid out there. In the past, DHS has not included that any estimate of any impact there in the fiscal note. So I defer
Mr.
to
Bostic,
them.
Thank you very much. The department is here, and I thought I'd let you know Mr. Held is here, and he wanted to address this issue. And members, just to let you know, if there's a direct appropriation, there is no fiscal note. Mr. Held?
Chair.
I thought he was.
Is he? Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Madam Chair, I couldn't tell if you were asking me to come up or saying I could if I wanted to.
Now we understand the hesitancy, Mr. Held.
I'm Bob Held from the Department of Human Services, and I must confess to feeling a bit chastised by this question. I don't believe we ever considered the issue of whether or not a fiscal note for the general moratorium funding should address whether there would be more single beds and that we would be paying for some of those single beds. And I think it's a very good point that Representative Loeffler is making, and that very well could and almost certainly would happen, and we will have to have some conversation about that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Held. Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, and I support going to single beds. I think that's what most people want, and it helps with infection control. I just think since our finances are pretty tight, we ought to just know going in kind of what it might add up to. The other question I just had is whether or not these moratorium exceptions would have to comply with the bill that you authored last year, Representative Schumacher, that had, you know, the demonstration of need to replace a facility, to, you know, move hardship situation. We had a variety of criteria that would have to be met in order to get approved as an exception to the moratorium, and would that apply to this? I don't see it in the reference, but I don't know these statutes that well.
Representative Schumacher?
I think Mr. Held would be best to
All right.
describe this.
Mr. Held.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, there were a couple of provisions that were relevant to this question that were enacted last year. One was the hardship provision, which had criteria in it that were specific to defining a hardship area in which the moratorium would allow new beds to be added. The other area was that where there are competitive moratorium projects, which is what this bill is addressing, there are criteria in statute that the commissioner is supposed to consider in selecting among those projects. New criteria were added last year to replace the existing criteria. And those are the criteria, there was 8 or 9 of them, that would be used in making determinations among competing projects.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just hope that we go with the hardship ones first beyond the second set. And I think you said this money was directed at the second, but I'm not sure about the interaction.
Mr. Held, do you have anything further?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. All right. Representative Schumacher, you have another testifier, I believe.
To that point for just a moment.
Okay, Mr. Bostic.
Thank you. Just a quick comment on to Representative Loeffler's question about hardship versus the other process. This funding is directed to the traditional moratorium of exceptions process, so the people who are eligible are existing nursing facilities for replacement or renovation of their capacity. It does not add any, the funding here does not add any new beds. It just updates the existing capacity. The hardship process is separate, and we're not requesting funding for that at this time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Bostic. And we do have Representative Liebling. Otherwise, we have another testifier. Do you want to ask your question now or wait?
I think so, Madam
okay.
Chair. Thank you. Right. Just so that I'm understanding this correctly, so the facilities that would be eligible for this funding could be local government owned, they could be nonprofits, or they could be for-profit institutions. Am I hearing that correctly?
Correct.
Mr. Bostic, okay, Representative.
Yes, it's any Medicaid-certified nursing home is eligible to submit an application for funding through this process.
Okay. Okay, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, and then thank you, Madam Chair. And then I guess maybe I'm not understanding this as well as I need to, but kind of going off of Representative Loeffler's question about, hardship. I mean, if there's obviously going to be competition for these funds, and so is there, I guess I'm concerned because we heard the other day that Mr. Held was testifying that, some of the nursing homes are doing just fine, and those tend to be the for-profit nursing homes. And then others are just struggling and close to closing. And I understand this is a limited set who are available for whom this money would be available. But within that range of need, if you will, is there any, here we would be authorizing some additional state funding? Would it be going? Could it possibly be going to those who are doing the best instead of those who have the most need?
Mr. Bostic.
Yes, to respond to that question, first of all, I just want to make a point because we used the phrase hardship a couple times. I just want to clarify. Hardship in the statute around the moratorium refers to an area of the state that has a hardship because they don't have enough beds. It's a provision for adding additional beds. Mm-hmm. For the funding of the moratorium exceptions projects, which apply to current facilities, it is competitive. It does not look at financial performance as one of the factors, per se, but it looks at basically what you're proposing to do and what the current condition of your facility is and how much is needed. In a lot of cases, what we're looking at is older nursing homes who need to update to serve consumers better and to remain competitive if they're going to continue to provide these services. So the funding itself is very valuable, and it does, in a sense, address hardships in terms of having older and less appealing places for people to live and be served.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so if I own a nursing home and it's a for-profit nursing home, and instead of investing in my facility, I just take more profit out, and so I'm doing, on the balance sheet, I'm doing pretty well because I'm, able to take out a lot of profit, but I'm not investing. And then I, need one of these moratorium exceptions. Can I then apply? And, my facility might look just awful because I've failed to invest in it. So in that case, there's nothing to stop me from getting these funds just like somebody else, right?
That's correct.
Mr. Bostic.
Thank you. That's correct, except that the proposal itself involves investment in the facility. You don't the money that's paid out here is paid out for actual costs spent on upgrading, improving the facility. So if you've not been doing that for a long time, you're probably more in need of applying for and accessing this money. But I'd also point out that every dollar that's paid out through this is paid out specifically tied to an investment that's made in the facility.
Thank you, Mr. Bostic. Representative Abler?
Oh, thanks. Maybe Mr. Held could come back for a question. Oh, you wanted to respond.
Okay, Mr. Bergstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. In addition to what Mr. Bostic just mentioned, the one other thing I would point out is the way this works is ultimately, let's say I'm going to do a large construction project, replace my building, it's going to cost $10 million. The way the formulas work, for-profit, non-profit, government-owned, et cetera, is generally speaking, to make that reimbursement for that property project work, you're going to need to put in about 20 or 30% equity. So when it's all said and done, these projects require not only a state investment, the federal match, and what the private pay, but also generally foundation help or fundraising or actually taking equity and putting it into the project.
Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom. Representative Abler.
Thanks, thanks, Mr. Held. Actually, kind of picking up on Representative Liebling's question. I'm glad I got here when I did. I spent the last year and a half triaging and prioritizing everything I can possibly think of to get through this time. When you consider these projects, and the list is longer than there's been money, which, and I am a second author on this bill, so I really support that we could try to do this, try to find the money. Do you ever consider the fiscal status of the place, or the fact that it's profit or nonprofit, or the general status of it, as part of one of the considerations?
Madam Chair, Representative,
yes, Mr. Held.
Abler, I've sat on the review panel that's done this anytime there's been an authority to move ahead with moratorium since 1998, and I don't recall ever having a discussion about, well, this place is a for-profit, or this place is losing a lot of money or making a lot of money, let's fund them or let's not fund them. In fact, the review panel, which is chaired by, formed by, and advises the Commissioner of Health, is consists of representatives from a variety of places, including both trade associations, so that there are for-profit and there are not-for-profit providers that sit on the review panel, as well as MDH and DHS and the Ombudsman Office and so forth.
All right. And I know that there's some for-profits that are on the edge of extinction as well as the nonprofits. I don't know that it's a clear-cut differentiation. I was just asking that question as a general question. But it sounds like it might be productive to add, you know, the fiscal status of a place, especially if they could fix it up, it might be more competitive to attract people, and especially in some of these rural ones that are, like we had the Watkins place last year that was about to collapse. We had to give them a special rate treatment. And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Schumacher, members. All right, this is being laid over for possible inclusion. Did you have any other testifiers? Anybody else here to testify?
No, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, I think we've all right, this bill is laid over for possible inclusion, and thank you, Mr. Schumacher, and Representative Abler will take over the rest of the committee.
Well, Representative Schumacher, welcome. So that's another special, you know, Schumacher day.
Yes.
Showtime. Anyway.
Showtime.
And members, Representative Schumacher did get to run the entire 50th meeting of this committee. This is the 52nd. 52 times we've met since we started.
Oh.
Who would have thought?
Happy anniversary.
Representative Schumacher, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 2717 for consideration and possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
So, yeah, this is for possible inclusion. So go ahead, Doug. Just bring your... tell us what you want to do.
All right, Mr. Chair and members, this bill repeals the requirement for dual certification in Medicare and Medicaid for nursing homes. Facilities would no longer be required to participate in Medicare Parts A and B. A referral system for Medicare residents is also established in here. Just a side on this, this comes from Strategy 1 and the recommendations in the Nursing Facility and Assisted Living Pilot Project that we heard testimony from Mr. Held a few weeks ago. In review, the pilot project was launched from last year's budget to determine what needs and options should exist for a facility or a level of care somewhere between assisted living and nursing homes. And after three regional meetings with 80 stakeholders throughout Minnesota, it was determined that a pilot project for this middle level of care wasn't really recommended. But instead of washing their hands of the project and just going to the beach to drink mango juice, the group did produce findings and offered other strategies.
for addressing the populations that require greater services than assisted living, but less than the expensive nursing facilities. The intent of this bill is to allow facilities the flexibility to reconsider participation in Medicare. They currently can do this, but the ones that do may lose existing construction status and would need Medicare's and would have to be met under Medicare's new construction status if they wanted to get back in, and that creates a great inhibitor for them. A facility may be interested in Medicaid-only certification to reduce federal requirements when the time and cost associated with it doesn't match the number of Medicare days that the facility currently sees. A facility that chooses this option also has the possibility of applying for different nursing staff waivers. There is a deterrent in this bill to avoid Medicaid reimbursements for a Medicare resident. A potential Medicare resident would be directed to another facility that does participate in Medicare. And if a Medicaid-only facility accepts a Medicare resident, that facility does not receive Medicaid reimbursements for that resident for the first 20 days of the stay, the average duration of what a Medicare stay is. The department has estimated that between one and two dozen facilities would opt to no longer participate in Medicare. And finally, there is a fiscal note of $13,000 that's associated with an ongoing contractor auditor to ensure that the Medicare residents are not in Medicaid-only facilities. And with that, we're ready for questions.
Members? I have a question for Mr. Held. It has nothing to do with any kind of fruit juice or anything. this $20,000, the contractor, I'm kind of puzzled by that. You assume that there'll be broad compliance and you assume no loss of funds, but you're going to hire a contractor to be sure that your assumption is correct. And what's this audit going to look like? And I'm not convinced this is necessary, but if you can persuade me why we need to have somebody else do this besides, like, you, for instance, or other people who work in your office who pay money to these folks, can you tell me about that, please?
Mr. Chair, the purpose of the audit isn't to ensure that the assumptions were correct. It's to ensure that the facilities that pull out of the Medicare program, in fact, do not admit people with qualifying Medicare stays. If we don't have a way to enforce that requirement, then I would assume that it would happen, and there would have to be substantial costs assigned to this bill.
I'm the chair. Let's just go a different way then. So you hire this contractor. Are they going to go out to the site? Are they going to collect data from these places? What's it look like? A guy with a clipboard walking around 24 places a couple hours a week or what?
I don't know exactly how it would be operated, Mr. Chair. I would anticipate that we would, as with our current audit activities, one, we wouldn't travel to each of these places to say, hey, let me look at all your admissions. We would spot check them and ask them to submit to us through electronic means information that we can use to confirm the status of something that we're auditing. In this case, it would probably consist of having some sort of a nurse consultant who would ask these facilities periodically for information about people that were admitted from the hospital and who were in the hospital for at least 3 days, because that would be suggestive that they would be Medicare, could have a Medicare qualifying stay, and then would want to look at an MDS or look at other information. We would already have access to the assessment, the MDS, but there could be other information that they would want to look at to determine if it was a Medicare qualifying stay.
Maybe you can help me on, so if a person is getting Medicare payments, do those go directly to the site from CMS, or do they come through you?
Medicare payments go directly from either CMS or more likely, I believe, the intermediary, which for Minnesota generally is Noridian, to the facility itself.
And couldn't we just tell the intermediary or CMS that not to send them any money and that they've opted out and have like a little form that they could fill out for free?
Mr. Chair, the CMS would know not to give them money and Noridian would know not to give them money because they've decertified from Medicare. The question is if they admit somebody who has a Medicare qualifying stay, but since they're not a Medicare certified provider, they cannot get paid for that service by Medicare. Therefore, Medicaid will be on the hook for that service that Medicare should be paying for. So what we want them to do, if they're going to decertify, is to refer a person who should have a Medicare qualifying stay to a Medicare certified facility so that Medicare can pay for that stay. When the Medicare coverage ends, then the person could choose to move to that non-certified facility.
And so this contractor would be relying on self-report, so basically, right? They wouldn't go through all the log of all the patients, or would they actually go there and sit in their office and kind of flip through the folders and or go electronically and see who they've admitted lately?
Well, Mr. Chair, we do have access to all of the assessments that are done, the minimum data set MDS assessments, and that includes an admission assessment. And so the audit process, without asking for anything from the facility, would have the ability to detect that there were so many admissions and some information about the nature of the person that was admitted.
And then the penalty would be that they wouldn't get paid 20 days because that's what they shouldn't have got paid for in the first place because they should have referred it out.
We feel that that would eliminate the need to assign a fiscal note cost for this.
Okay. Would there be a savings if they found one because those people should have gone to a Medicare certified one and got paid 50-50, right? Or does Medicare pay 100% for those?
Mr. Chair, Medicare pays the entire the rate thing. For the first 20 days, and for the next 80 days of Medicare coverage, there's a copay of somewhere around $150 a day.
I understand.
That we may or may not pay if the person's on Medicaid.
This is helpful. I appreciate you sitting through my interrogation. Representative Liebling, Part B of the interrogation is now underway.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We're good cop, bad cop. I'm just not sure which is which.
Oh, you can be the good cop now.
Thanks. Well, Mr. Held, I feel like even after all the years I've been on this committee, there's a lot I don't understand. We were talking about this the other day, Mr. Chair, right?
Yeah.
How much there is to know. And I think I'm understanding the intent of the bill. In other words, if that we, the state of Minnesota, shouldn't be paying for something that ought to be paid for under Medicare by the feds. But why would a facility not be Medicare certified? That's what I'm not getting. Why do we have some that are just Medicaid certified and not Medicare certified?
Mr. Help.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the current law tells facilities that are in Medicaid, you must get Medicare certification. If they're denied it, then they've tried to comply with the law, and that's satisfactory. But they have to seek Medicare certification so that anybody who goes into a nursing home and is a Medicare beneficiary and is going to receive a Medicare-eligible service will get Medicare reimbursement. And that's been in state law for many, many, many years, probably about 30 years. What we're doing here is suggesting that we give the facilities the flexibility of deciding that they want to be in Medicare or they do not want to be in Medicare. That's the fundamental purpose of what this provision is doing. It's allowing them to pull out of the Medicare program if for some reason they desire that flexibility. We believe that the facilities that would desire to do that would be those that have very, very low Medicare days. And so having Medicare certification more or less has an adverse impact on their business pattern, on the staffing levels and the types of expertise that they have to provide for just a very small part of their population. And allowing them to decertify and not care for those people would allow them to change the nature of the operation of the facility if they choose to do that. The concern is, if they decide to back out of Medicare and they continue to admit people who should be getting reimbursed by Medicare, then Medicaid is going to have a cost.
Yeah.
And the desire of the author on this bill was to allow the flexibility but not to have a huge fiscal note in doing so. And so this requirement to refer those people for those days that they're going to have Medicare coverage and to allow us to provide a minimal amount of oversight of that was why there's the small fiscal note that there is.
Representative Liebling.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for that, Mr. Held. But I guess I'm still not understanding, though, why, what, maybe you could just give an example of, you know, what the extra burden is to be Medicare certified then. And also, if they decide they don't want to be Medicare certified, okay, I get that we don't want them to just kind of cheat and then and put the costs on the state instead. Mm-hmm. But if we're going to let them do that, are we making sure then that there is actually a Medicare certified facility someplace convenient for those patients? I mean, you know, or in some rural areas, might there not be?
Mr. Held, there's probably a couple questions.
A couple questions there, exactly.
They're both good.
Thank you, Mr.
All
Chair.
All three or whatever, however many there are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, no, there's nothing in the bill that assures that there will still be comparable access in a specific area after this provision, and it could be a problem for some people to have to travel further to get that stay. But I would remind you that the Medicare stay itself is a very short duration. So it's, in terms of the imposition on those individuals and the ability of friends to visit and so forth, it does create a short-term burden, similar to what would happen to somebody living in a town that does not have a hospital and has to go to another town for a service that they require from a hospital. And that also is a short stay. But the bill does not address that problem. And if you would remind me what the other question was.
Yeah.
Oh, what costs and burdens does somebody have to come up with to be Medicare certified compared to being Medicaid
Thank
certified?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The way the providers, this was based in large part on input from providers in the stakeholder meetings we conducted. You recall several weeks ago I presented to this committee about the pilot, the nursing facility assisted living pilot project, and this was one of the recommendations that we had in that report for the legislature to suggestions to consider as a way of providing greater flexibility. And the driving concern there was the difficulty that rural facilities, especially deeper rural facilities, have in continuing to operate. And I think in this case, it's also driven by somewhat by proximity to critical access hospitals that have Medicare swing beds, where a great deal of the Medicare business is actually done in a Medicare swing bed, which is a hospital bed being used as a skilled nursing facility bed for a short period of time. And that means that the nursing homes that are near them do not get to do that business, and if they do get to do it, they get very little of it. So, because generally Medicare is considered a very profitable aspect of the nursing home's business. And so, you know, at first we puzzled, well, why would you want to get rid of your most profitable thing? But then on the other hand, why do we have to require them to do the most profitable thing? And the explanation that I was given by providers was that there's certain staffing things, particularly around RN staffing, which in these areas is very hard to access for them, that is very costly, and that they would need to do any amount of Medicare. If they're going to do one person occasionally or two or three or four people at a time, the impression that I was given by the providers was that they're still going to have to staff to a certain level. But if they're only getting that sporadic use of the Medicare service, then it's not covering the cost of that, and it ends up that it actually costs them money to provide that service rather than being able to show a profit on that service.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Held, that you're kind of getting to the answer that I'm looking for. You're kind of going around it a little bit, and that was helpful. But so aside from, you know, I guess I'm looking for something more specific, because I'm trying to, you know, I guess what we're weighing here is this to the benefit of our folks across the state to give those providers this flexibility, okay? And so I want to weigh, what is the burden on them? I mean, what is it specifically? You mentioned staffing requirements, and I guess I could understand that since, you know, if you're in that 20-day Medicare stay, chances are you've just come out of the hospital or something, you've got higher acuity, I assume, and yeah. That's when you get paid for that acuity, too.
Okay.
So I'm really not getting a good picture here of, you know, what is the burden, what is the additional burden on them? And I'm also thinking that if you know, if it is just that they have to have some additional staff, and maybe they're not always using that additional staff for Medicare patients, I bet some of their Medicaid patients are benefiting from that additional staff.
Representative Liebling, maybe I'll have Mr. Bostic come down, and would that be a good idea? Mm-hmm. To answer, because I think Mr. Sure, Held has kind of exhausted his specific content here. I've gotten to recognize that over the years, so. Or whichever, so you get the team coming down. Mr. Held, we phoned some friends here who are going to. I'm the good cop, good. Anyway, whichever. Anyway, so
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I'm glad to take a shot at that question. I think that my answer is going to be somewhat similar to what Mr. Held was just giving.
As specific as we can get. We have the theme going here. So
the explanation that I've heard of this is that in facilities where you don't do a lot of Medicare business, you still have to be prepared to address the needs of those patients, and I think that the key point is that Medicare patients are quite a bit different than Medicaid patients in general. I mean, we kind of think of the nursing home population as being, fairly homogeneous, but the Medicare patients are people receiving relatively intensive services right after they've been in the hospital, usually for only about 20 days, sometimes a little bit longer. Medicaid patients have often been in the facility a year or more. There's fewer of them than there used to be, but there's still people who are there a long time, relatively stable, just need some assistance with activities of daily living and things like that. So the thought here is that if you can focus your services on the longer-term people who are not necessarily easier to serve but can be served with a less intensive staffing model, that it's a little bit more efficient than having to be certified for Medicare, having to be prepared to handle the needs of those people when you may only get one or two now and then.
Well, Mr. Held, actually, you both said the same thing, and I appreciate the consistency in your answer. maybe unless somebody knows any numbers, it sounds like the numbers people, specifics aren't available today, but if you could help us just get some, like, is it 20% more cost to maintain that because you have to have those rehab people around or whatever? That would be helpful, and I think that's all we, unless somebody else knows that, either anybody at the table or somebody in the audience, I think we have to be dissatisfied with the.
Mr. Chair, the one thing I could note in that regard is that the average Medicare rate is more than double the average Medicaid rate. Right. And that suggests to you that there's a great deal more cost associated with caring for that population.
Oh, yeah. You want to take a crack at it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the one thing I would add to Mr. Held, Mr. Bostic's testimony is what we're really talking about are very small nursing facilities that would probably think to utilize this. So think in terms of a building that has 20 or 30 beds and the fixed costs associated with trying to participate in the Medicare program is a hurdle for them. They're just trying to serve the long-term MA chronic and trying to staff towards some of those things is much easier if you're a big building. If you're a small building, it becomes increasingly difficult.
Okay. We're going to do about 5 more minutes on this bill. So there's 3 more questioners. So then there's a pretty big bill coming up. So Representative Fritz, Scott Walt, and then Kiffman. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is to any of the testifiers. But, you know, as a rural person who is of Medicare age and has cared for many Medicare patients in my nursing home. And at times, and I think today if I were to call down there, we you know, if we're a 120-bed facility, I probably don't have 20 Medicare patients in the facility. I probably have 8. And then I have Medicaid, and then I have private paid, and then it's long-term and all of that considered. But my issue is access, you know, for those of us in rural Minnesota. You know, if I need to get to a Medicare bed, I want it, and my folks want to be in Faribault. The Faribault people want to stay in Faribault. We hope that we can have that. We have 3 large nursing homes that do have Medicare certification. But there are smaller areas. If they're 20, you know, then I think that's something to be considered. But for my thoughts are that there are the access for those, for many people. And, you know, a lot of people think they're on Medicare and it's going to pay for everything in the nursing home from now until forever, and it doesn't. You know, that it pays the 20, 30, and 90 days, and a lot of the folks that I took care of are constantly appealing to get Medicare coverage because they didn't get better as fast. And so there's a lot involved, and that does take time and money and people to help facilitate that. But my biggest issue here with this bill is access for those of us in rural Minnesota. So I would like, you know, to, I'm thinking if there's a 20-bed nursing home, and I don't know, I don't have any that low, that doesn't even compare with my 120-bed homes. So I think that's where your bill should be focusing on those, on a 20-bed home, and the rest of them should have access to those 10 or 20 Medicare beds.
Representative Fritz, and I don't know if we have time for them to answer this question, but I think if I can turn it into a homework assignment for the author or the people promoting this bill, if they could give us kind of just a scattergram of where these places, where the likely ones are to be, I think that'll answer the question that's come up a couple of times. So, Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, that answers my question, too. I had a concern about how this impacted rural nursing homes versus maybe metro area.
Well, I think the concern, I have the same concern, because these are rehab people. They're 20 days, 60 days, whatever. In a rehab thing, their family wants to see them, and they're going to have to drive 90 miles to do whatever. So, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we're all thinking the same way. So, but matter of fact, this can be very helpful for that. Keep people close to home, because this is largely rehab. And that is where family members do want to see them or are helping with their care or doing other things like that. They're often younger. They're often mentally competent as well. They're in good shape. They just had a knee replacement or a hip surgery or some other kind of thing where they need an in-between place, but they can't go home and live on their own yet. So they're often very vibrant people, but being close to familiarity and their friends, if we can do something. But I think other than that, it's not really a question, Representative Schumacher. I think you'll get the answer. We'll all get the answer when you get to do your homework.
I think we all four had the same question, Representative Hill. Mr. Hill, you represented that. It was a compliment.
I think I lost my last election, Mr. Chair. there's one other point that I just feel compelled to make, and I totally agree with the representatives that have raised the issue of access, and I think that access is very important, and that's one of the reasons why I fought for so many years to get the hardship provision that was enacted last year. I want to note, though, that I think there's a competing value that isn't one that any of us can influence, and the value is quality. And the point that I've seen made in the literature quite often is that, and it's usually in the context of fairly complex medical procedures, like, say, coronary arterial bypass surgery, that a hospital or a surgeon that do this once in a while, a few times a year, their outcomes are not as good as somebody who does it several times a week, that do lots and lots of these, or a hospital that does 10 of these procedures a day. Well, geriatric nursing home rehab is not quite as complex as that, but I believe it shares that same principle. If I needed rehab in a nursing facility for whatever reason, I would much rather go to a facility that has rehab therapists that do it a lot, that do it often, than have the much closer access. I think there's a value to it being more concentrated. And this not only provides that flexibility for those facilities that do very little of it and feel that it's not good for them as a facility, but I think it adds the quality value for the consumers that are going to then go to facilities that are doing larger portions of this kind of care.
I think that makes sense. And then if it could, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It doesn't make sense to me. And the reason it doesn't make sense to me is because if you're on Medicaid, you may need that very same service. You're just not over 65. You're just poor. You may need that same service. So now you're in a home that isn't Medicare qualified and has a lower level, perhaps, of staffing, but you need that very same service. So you may be getting worse quality under this bill. That's how I...
That's a fair question. Good point to bring up. Was that the bad cop then you were being?
I think it's an off here.
All right. And so let me do a good cop thing, that just to close this out. I think that one point, though, that just from Bob, Mr. Held's, let me call it representative again, from Mr. Held's last comments, is that it may be that the marginal cost this place is incurring to keep a credential that they never use may be the thing that drives them out of business, so there's nothing at that site. And you can, somebody knows how many places have closed involuntarily in the last 5 years. Some are overpopulated areas, some are now underserved, and so that's the other countervailing interest here. So, Representative Schumacher, you have an interesting idea on this, and I think we need some data, and we're going to hold it over for possible inclusion. How's that? And so I think the imperative folks who wanted this have some homework to do and some people to convince, so whoever brought it forward. So it's held over. Thank you. Another bill. Who's the author of this one? Oh, Representative Schumacher. So you want to move this for possible inclusion, and you have some amendments, is that right?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 1979 to be held over for possible inclusion in your omnibus bill.
And you have the A2 amendment, do you?
I do, and we'll begin with that, the A2 amendment.
So this bill has been heard elsewhere, so you should explain it to us. I see you phoned some friends to explain it to us.
And actually,
so, do you want to explain it? You can.
Mr. Chair, we do have a couple of changes that we want to make to this amendment.
Do you have an oral amendment? Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Want to describe your oral amendments to us, or does Mr. Nelson want to do it?
If Mr. Nelson could report those for us.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bruce Nelson with ARM. Yeah. And these are two of the changes came about last night on a bill that is now gone. Representative Gottwald is carrying for the for NAMI. The first change would be on line 1.10 after the period. Insert, this certification is voluntary for license holders.
Would you please repeat that again?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, shall I repeat it for you?
This after certification, it's after the period on line 1.10. This certification is voluntary for license holders.
Did everybody get that? Okay.
That's a clarification of the intent. On 2.4, delete and then renumber.
Oh, so we're going to delete line 2.4?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then on, those are both from last night. And then on 4.17, delete the word developmental.
So everybody, just to repeat the amendments on line 1.10, after the period we're inserting, this certification is voluntary for licensees, license holders, is that what it was? Mm-hmm. License holders, we're deleting line 2.4, and on line 4.17, we're deleting the word developmental. Everybody understand that oral amendment? Questions? All in favor say aye. 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 Opposed? Adopted. Your amendment, Representative Stonewall.
All right, and again, I'll ask Mr. Nelson to explain some of the agreements that he's been able to reach with this
thank
amendment.
You. Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So if you want to explain the amendment, or do you want to explain the amendment in the context of the whole bill?
I think it'd be easier, Mr. Chair, to explain the amendments in the context.
Okay, we'll do that, then we'll adopt the amendment after you do with your explanation. So I think that's appropriate. It's appropriate to put a bill in order the author wants when it's at the first hearing, in my opinion. So when it's been somewhere else, then it's more appropriate to explain the changes, and then the committee can choose to adopt your great ideas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll proceed. Just very briefly, I believe most of you heard the bill is introduced in the Reform Committee. What we are trying to do in this bill is find savings within corporate foster care, realizing that the current level of funding is unsustainable and that we have waiting lists, and doing that through various types of innovation. And we are trying to facilitate other options for people to choose other than corporate foster care for people who arguably are overserved in corporate foster care that could do well with a less expensive and more person-centered approach in other services. So we do things in the bill to try to facilitate that to happen. And one of the ways we do that is by breaking down various barriers in the system. So that's very briefly the intent. I'll add one other thing, that the issue of unsustainability of corporate foster care has been before you many times in the last few years. And there have been measures that have been before you that you've adopted, such as the moratorium on corporate foster care beds. There were things that came out of the special session, like the 10% lower need congregate care cut, the delicensing of beds in corporate foster care. It's clear the direction that the state is going, and we recognize that. We recognized that a long time ago, that we must have other alternatives for people if we're going to meet the needs of people now being served, or people on waiting lists, or people to come in future generations. The important thing that we're also looking at is, how do we make sure we don't destabilize the system in moving forward? And so there are provisions in here that try to address that, so that, yes, if people are moving out, we don't totally disrupt the system they're leaving behind them. And that's one of the principal reasons that we're trying to take a thoughtful, planful approach to where you've been going in the last couple of years. Section 1, and Ms. Abderholden may want to speak to this, it's a certification process, a goodwill standard. Do you want to explain this?
And so to the testifiers, we need to get through all this by 2:15, so I think there's ample time, but I just want to make sure you keep that in mind.
Mr. Chair, I might add that and the amendment that's before you, the Section 1 in the engrossment has been deleted, and it's the first page and a half of the amendment.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Abderholden. I wasn't trying to make you rush. I'm just going to keep people apprised of time. So,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. I'll talk fast since some of you have heard this before. Basically, what this does is create a voluntary certification process for corporate foster care homes. So if they train their staff on mental illness, if they have access to a mental health practitioner or a mental health professional, if they have a crisis plan both for the individual and the home, then they can get kind of a little good housekeeping seal of approval that says, you know, yes, we serve people with mental illness. And then it's just kind of a very transparent way that whether it's a county, a hospital, social worker, and they're trying to place someone, they know that that particular home has some additional trained staff on mental illness. And that's it.
Well, Ms. Abderholden, this is, when you look back on your career, this could be one of the things you'll look back and be very proud of if we can get this to go. You've been working on this a long time. So
I will.
I hope we can get this done this year.
Thank you.
Mr. Nelson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I may add to that too, it's my understanding that the language that was in the second engrossment carried a fiscal note of $42,000, and that the amended language no longer carries a fiscal note. That, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I think.
Saving money, that's good. Okay.
I'll turn it over to Ms. Turner.
Yeah, please, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, but Barb Turner, ARM. And I will talk briefly also. Section 2 of the bill allows for licensing 5 beds for adult foster care. This was something that was in legislation a few years ago, and the actual expiration date to do that expired in June of 2012. One of the things that had to happen in order for it to be able to be implemented was for the department to make a request for a waiver amendment to pay for a 5 beds in a facility. and that hasn't happened for the DD waiver or the CAC waiver yet, so we're asking for an extension of the ability to do that five-bed licensing to allow those providers to actually be able to utilize that option. We have an end date of 2016, which, just to let people know, it is a different date than the department has in their bill, but they said they are willing to go with our date, so they didn't change their bill. But, and the second part of Section 2 allows the ability for people who then have a fifth bed option to utilize that option for respite care, with some limitations on how frequently and how many days someone can utilize that option. Section 3 has to do with basically doing some clarifying language on the alternative license for overnight supervision in adult foster care. This is already something that's allowed, but we've done some tightening up to confirm who can't get that particular kind of license, what things would prevent someone from doing that. And in Section 4, we've done some additional language to clarify exactly what the expectations are, which would require a application and a checklist for providers to go through in order to apply for that license, that alternative license. In Section 5, we are actually, didn't we take out Section 5?
That was deleted.
Yeah, not in what I'm looking at, but the intent was to take Section 5 out.
That's on line 2.2 of the amendment.
Okay. Sorry about that. All right. Section 6 has to do with when people have service plans. That is what directs providers as to the kinds of services they should be providing. Oftentimes there will be team meetings where decisions are made to make changes to the services or to some kind of expectation, and the service plans are not always updated or updated promptly, so we simply want documented meeting minute notes that are signed and agreed upon by teams or people who attended the meeting for those to be considered amendments to the individual service plans. Section 7, this section has to do with background studies, and currently for people who are getting a background study in licensed services, they do not have to have annual background studies as long as they remain employed and assigned with the agency that they have the study done through. For unlicensed services, there is now a requirement for background studies, but it doesn't give that exception, so they still are required on an annual basis. We're simply asking that they be done similarly, so that as long as an individual stays assigned to a provider, they don't need an annual study. They do have to do at least 40 hours of work per year in a licensed facility. That has to do with the kind of follow-up of how the department may be notified if somebody commits a crime or is convicted of something once they've had a background study done, which kind of leads into Section 8, which deals with the responsibilities for probation and correction officers in relation to reporting to the department if they have someone who they're dealing with who has been convicted of something that could disqualify them, and if they find that that person does has been working in a licensed facility, then there's a reporting process to the department. Section 9, individual service plan that we talked about earlier, the same plan. Currently, the case managers are responsible for doing those plans, and providers are supposed to be operating their services based on those plans. Providers don't always get those plans in a timely manner or get revised plans, or sometimes don't get a plan at all, and we simply don't want providers to see any negative effects from something that they don't have control over. So once they make a request for the plan and make a re-request, if it's not there, and this has to do with a federal OIG audit where a couple providers had been held financially responsible for and were going to, in essence, have money taken back for services they provided because they didn't have an ISP. Section 10 is in some modifications to the State Quality Council. This is a council that's already in place, and we've simply added a couple duties to the council's responsibilities that would pertain to reviewing financial and personal risks that currently impede people from making choices about where they might want to live in the community, and then making recommendations to the chairs and the legislative committees in January of 13. Section 11 gives a definition of, states that if people are going to, if a service provider is going to be the provider of housing or have control over housing, that there be a plan in place so that the transition of the lease to directly to the individual occur in a two-year time frame to give control, more control of the housing to the individual.
Mr. Chair, I'll address section 12,
please,
which is in the amendment,
which is replaced. The section 12 in the bill is deleted, right, and there's a new section 12. Please,
and
Mr.
and
no.
That's a result of conversations that are still ongoing, but reflecting, we think, many of the needs of the counties as we move this forward. So,
okay,
I wanted to, you know, reiterate, in particular to this session, one of the purposes of the bill, and how we think items like the delicensing provision and the 10% reduction and how that was what it was trying to get to. Now, we agree with the direction that it was trying to achieve, and that is to move folks out of who choose to and are arguably overserved in corporate foster care, to move them or allow them to move if they so choose. We don't agree with that approach. For example, the delicensing provision would, if a person chose to move, that leaves three people whose choices haven't been consulted with necessarily, but the 25% of the funding's gone, and it destabilizes the system. So we were looking for ways to be more planful and looked at various models, including the nursing home model of moving folks from, or allowing them to move from nursing homes to the elderly, to the elderly waiver. What we came up with is, and I should note there was a fiscal note attached to the original language. It had a small upfront cost, and then in the next 2 years, considerably more in savings. And I don't know. We've sent the language to
the. We're still waiting for a fiscal.
We don't know what how the fiscal ramifications would be handled.
You can kind of wrap up your summary of the bill. We have a lot of discussion.
Okay. I was dwelling on this because there's been some controversy around this, and yeah, some of you may receive some emails, and I wanted to clarify what it was.
Oh, which section is that you're talking about?
Pardon me?
12. The 12. New 12?
Yeah. Okay. And other testifiers may want to address this as well. We've had discussion from various quarters, advocates and from us and others, that we don't really have a sense of the capacity that we need in corporate foster care. And so before moving ahead with what this would do is provide for voluntary closure of corporate foster care and provide a six-month upfront extra reimbursement to facilitate that. Some of them, the money would also go to lead agencies or counties. But before, all of this really happens, let's get a sense of what are the needs of folks, what is the capacity we need in corporate foster care, and then let's lay out, as this amendment calls for, some criteria that we would look for in terms of cost savings and meeting the needs of the individuals. We may have further discussions around how families are involved in this, but
that's a good idea, Mr. Nelson.
Yeah. Yeah, and we had a conversation this morning as well. So I'll with that, if there are more questions, I'll get back.
Okay, and you know, there's 25 minutes left, but that's going to go awfully quick. I'm going to ask probably Ms. Plummer's Russ to come down, or Mr. Kerber and Ms. Hamilton. But first I want to ask that one of the witnesses, Ms. Krolik, had to leave or something. What's your time schedule like?
Well,
you have a little time,
I probably have 10 or 15 minutes left here.
Okay. Well, at 2 o'clock you can come testify and give your 2 minutes. But I want to hear from the department first. That might be productive for your comments anyway. So if you would come down. I know there's a lot of testifiers on the list, this is the money committee. We've already had a bunch of testimony. Please have a chair. And Representative Schumacher, you can stay with them, of course. That's nice to have you here. You look good in orange.
Thank you.
It is MS Day. Oh, mango colored. I'm sorry. It's mango colored. I apologize. This bill's had two hearings at the reform level and GovOps talking about some of the nuances. I'm now interested in knowing the position of the department in both the licensing questions and in some of the policy questions on this. We can't ask money questions yet because you got the fiscal note yet. But let me, between the two of you, I'm curious on, well, the bill has licensing all over it. Mm-hmm. And so I want Mr. Kerber to respond in a 3-minute summary. And then, Ms. Hamilton, if you'd respond in a similar amount of time about the 50% number. I really like that number. And what the position of the department would be on allowing up to 50% of a non-4-unit place to be used for sites, and about the 5 beds, and why it has to be so. I think that's already in your policy, Bill. But why is it so restrictive, only it can be respite once in a while? So if you want to think about that. Mr. Kerber, do you want to comment about this bill's approach to licensing, and just to give us a flavor of, is this going to be vetoed? Are you kind of cool with it? Are we going the right way? Is there room to work on it? Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm an Inspector General's Office of the Department of Human Services. It includes the Licensing Division. And we weren't really preparing to sort of present anything, but here really to answer any questions you might have, and that's a big one.
My question is, what's your thumbnail analysis?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, we spent a fair amount of time working with ARM on the language, and I think for the most part in the licensing area, it reflects sort of what we worked out as workable language. Certainly the background study area, that makes sense. It's a good idea. We're fully supportive of that. Some of these provisions about extending the bed capacity in foster care up to 5, it's not quite as easy as this, unfortunately, because there are some other restrictions still that exist, in my understanding, in the federal waiver plan. And so people can't be reimbursed under DD waiver if there's more than 4 people in a home. And so we can issue a license, but then nobody can get paid. So I don't know that that's going to actually roll out as quickly as people might want it to in this case.
And even for respite?
Is
that a compensable thing, and then you're going to get a waiver to have 5 all the time? Is that what the plan is?
Mr. Chair, I think the respite, as I understand, is a different situation. And we do give waivers now, our variances now, that allow for that 5th bed emergency respite. I think this sort of changes the flavor just a little bit, so it's not an emergency or a crisis that's going to have this. Certainly we've heard there are some concerns about, just functionally how this would work in talking with ARM. It would not be that there are ever more than 4 people in that home, even though they're allowing this respite person to come in. It would be when somebody who normally lives there is not there for a weekend, for perhaps. If somebody, on a regular basis, they go home or every other weekend. And so that, while it isn't stated quite that clearly, that was the intent that was conveyed to us, and it's sort of in that line where it talks about staffing ratios cannot be reduced on page 2.31. So the idea there is that there probably would never be more than 4 anyway, so it's not really up against that issue. The other issues we've heard about, though, is that then it sort of changes the flavor of the home. If I live in a setting and up to 2 different people per month can come in and spend the weekends in the spare bedroom that we have, it's a little different for me living there. But, you know, those are the concerns about that. But as far as operationalizing these amendments as it relates to licensing, I think we'll be able to do that.
Thank you. And back to the question about the five beds. I don't understand the objection to a fifth bed. Is that a federal issue right now? We have to get a waiver for that, and that's in process again because it was extended, and then it sunsetted. Maybe Ms. Hamilton, this one's for you.
Mr. Abler, or excuse me, Mr. Chair.
It's just catching on all over the place.
My name is Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. Currently, our waiver plans are in the process of being amended to allow that fifth bed from that language that passed in 2009. We had two of the waivers have been amended and two are in the process of being amended, and that's why in our policy bill we proposed to extend that to 2014. So it's not an issue with the federal government necessarily. They may have questions with us as we renew the waiver plans with them about why we are going to five bed, but it's really an issue of what our currently approved waiver plan says.
Okay, well then I'm unclear about your policy. I thought the policy bill is something about grandfathering in something or other, and then you were going to do a permanent request for up to five beds, like forever. Is that true or is that not true?
Mr. Chair, the policy bill only extends the five-bed request until 2014, so that providers can be licensed under that five-bed until 2014.
And why would we stop that?
Because we, Mr. Chair, we are prefer smaller settings. They're less costly, and they provide more choice and more consumer control. It's also a national trend to have smaller settings. Four is actually kind of large for nationally, so we want to continue with that trend.
And what if it's the will of the legislature have it be five forever? Is that going to be a conflict with your department then?
Mr. Chair, that would not be in the direction that the department is wanting to head.
All right. Thank you. And the 50% request in the bill, it says that up to 50, I've been in many discussions about this number. Can you describe the direction of the department on 50% of a site being used for some kind of services?
Mr. Chair, I think we've had lots of discussions with ARM and other stakeholders about this language, and I think we're getting closer. 50% is better than no limit whatsoever. We will have to look at it with the fiscal note. That's the major concern is related to how much that would cost, because it would open up a service, customized living, to people who are currently living in their home, and that's a more expensive service, and so it may add cost to the waiver program.
And Ms. Hamilton, do you think that people would perhaps also leave a four-unit place to go to one of the apartments or sites like that so they would actually have less services? Those kind of folks have some place to go?
Mr. Chair, that is possible. Mm-hmm. We'd have to look at that as we do the fiscal analysis. And the other components of this language related to the separation of housing provider from the service provider, we are supportive of that direction.
Okay. I personally, I think, just to remind you what we've chatted about in private with some of you and others, I'm convinced that some people are trapped in a four-unit place and they don't need to be there and get services that are as extensive as that, and that they would love to go to a place where they could have some supportive services, and that there's been somewhat of a moratorium or a roadblock on some of those being developed. And so the higher the number you can come up with that you can live with on the 50%, if it's that or some other number, I think it'll result in savings and actually better quality for folks. So I'm just encouraging you along that way. So those are Representative Loeffler. And actually, in 2 minutes, we're going to revert to a testifier. So, but go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually think you're right that there are people who are in foster care who could live under SILS. In Hennepin, they've been able to actually work with older people. I think it'll work much more effectively with the younger people to transition them into ownership, limited equity, co-ops, those sorts of things, which to me is a way to go rather than for us to keep paying for the same apartments or same buildings forever and ever. And so I think I'm a little concerned about us getting into providers being landlords of, you know, large apartment buildings, even if half have someone else, because I think that just kind of builds us in long-term with less client choice. But I'm concerned about the same effect on the five-bed, because to staff for five, you really have to have lower-need people, generally, to add that extra person. And so you may have a real incentive to keep a low-need person or two in the mix in order to, mm-hmm. you know, have five more in the home, and that you actually cancel out your goal, which is, and it's hard for people to get along with. I wouldn't want to have four roommates I didn't pick. I think it's hard for lots of people, but I have heard from staff who work in this business that particularly with people with behavior problems, who are the people who should be in more supervised settings, less independent settings, that each time you change things, you can change the whole dynamics of the home and the mix. And so I would like us to, as this evolves, look at the provisions for the respite in terms of who has input. Because right now it looks like the home has total control and they don't even have to talk to the family members or the people living there. They just have to notify them once it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And I think we could create some real disruption in some homes that are working right now.
Representative Lafferty, you're on the committee that's going to be doing that work. So this will be coming back up as a part of a future project, I'm sure. So maybe we can move to testimony. Ms. Trollick? And then we'll get on the list. We have about 2 minutes each for comments. This has been a productive dialogue. Mm-hmm. Mr. Weber, are you going to testify? You were just there for a resource, right? Probably. So if Mr. Lindholm wants to come up next, have a chair, ma'am. And Mr. Lindholm, you can be on deck, and then Ms. Ring, and then the rest. So welcome to the committee, and I'm sorry I only have 2 minutes for you, but please, thanks for sticking around and being part of the dialogue.
Thank you. 2 minutes will do it.
Okay.
Hello, I'm Peggy Krolick, and I'm the mother of a special needs young man who currently lives in a four-person group home. I would like to comment on Section 12 of Bill 1979, the Adult Foster Care Voluntary Closure piece, and give a personal perspective on it. My son has been in his home for 3 years now, and we purchased the home with another family, and four residents moved in at the same time, and they have become like family to one another. We have two higher functioning residents and two lower functioning residents. We have two boys and two girls. They help one another and they depend on one another just like a regular family. And actually, we couldn't ever have anticipated how well it would work. We went in knowing it was risky. Now, if the county were to decide that our two higher functioning residents should leave and relocate, as you call it, then all of the residents would be somewhat traumatized, if not very traumatized. I liken it to dividing up children from one family and relocating half of them to some open bed somewhere, away from everything they have come to know. Community, friends, other residents, staff, their church, their work, etc. And this is all to be done without the consent of the residents or their families or their guardians. So I wonder where the human compassion is in this sort of action. Going forward, perhaps alternative solutions should be looked at for different levels of functioning. But to disrupt current homes that are in place and functioning well is a big mistake. And at the same time, I think you decision makers should realize that what you will end up with is a four-person group home with four severely disabled residents requiring probably four staff for all waking hours, and maybe two staff at night. So I'm not sure that this is a really good budget solution. And more importantly, I would be very concerned about the quality of life in a home like this. The staff would have a very difficult job. They should be paid more for that kind of a job. And I think the relationships between the residents could be very difficult to foster.
Thanks. You're pushing 3 minutes.
I'm done.
2 minutes. Okay. I have a question for you.
That's my last word.
Okay. 2 minutes goes really fast. I just have one question for you. On the funding of the housing component, I think, is GRH. And so are you getting $600-some dollars times four? for the housing component?
Yes.
Okay. And, all right, thank you.
Yes.
Thanks for coming, and I appreciate that. And I really only have 2 minutes a person, so if Mr. Lindholm and then Ms. Ring, then Ms. Hulbert, and Ms. Zuspan, that'll actually burn up all the time. So, oh, and we have to do an amendment yet. So we'll get it done. So maybe a minute and a half, sir. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chairman.
I've come all this way, so thanks.
I'll do my best. My name is Wayne Lindholm, and I testify today as a parent of a child with a disability living in a DD waiver home. As a parent, I appreciate and understand the intent of this bill. However, I have a number of reservations about how House File 1979 was created and the current version before the committee today. However, I'll just focus on two things. First, while the bill represents a body of work from many well-intended people, the process used to draft the bill falls short of the rigor required for the most vulnerable adult residents of our state. In short, it lacks thorough protection from the group of stakeholders most affected by the changes that this bill will set in motion, our adult children and residents with disabilities. Not surprisingly, the bill as written has a bit of an institutional feel to it and is lacking a consumer voice in many areas. Dr. Hulbert has testified well to this point. She will follow me, and she's testified in other Senate and House committees before this. Second, as an example of my concern as a parent with the lack of protection for our vulnerable children, I speak to Sections 3 and 4 pertaining to alternate overnight supervision technology. There are about 14,000 people with developmental disabilities receiving the DD waiver. A waiver is an alternative to ICF, and ICF levels of care means 24 hours of supervision. The Center for Medical and Medicaid Services does not allow video cameras as a substitute for human supervision. I understand pressures building on the Department of Human Services to allow new technologies. There may be many providers using video technology today without any legal framework in place allowing them to do so.
Mr. Lindholm, that's actually
thank you.
Real quick. But so do you want to just offer a summary sentence? That'd be
yes.
Fine.
In closing, I strongly believe this bill is not ready for passage and should be held over not for inclusion, but held over until next fall session to address the additional work to be done. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you. Ms. Ring, would you come down, please? And just because of time, Ms. Hulbert, we've heard quite a bit of your testimony in other committees, so if you could just defer today, it would be, and pass out a written thing, that'd be nice. And then if Dr. Zuspan wants to come up and take a minute and a half. Ms. Ring, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr.
And actually, would you describe the process you go through if this were to go into law, what the counties would do as they move certain individuals? Would they just kind of willy-nilly disrupt a group, or would they kind of consider the groups? I presume that they're going to be thoughtful about this. You say what you wanted to say and then answer that question, if you will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will have to think for a second about that question.
Okay, that's why I told you ahead of time.
In a nutshell, to be very brief, the counties continue to have some concerns with Section 12 of this bill, the voluntary closure of beds. We've talked at length with Representative Schumacher and folks from ARM, and they included a number of our issues in the amendment that was before you today. We know we still have work to do, and we look forward, if the bill is laid over, to continuing to work with them and you, because there are some other ideas related to this on the table in other bills and in other amendments that we prefer that would allow for, we think, more community and consumer input into a gaps analysis. And so in a nutshell, I'll leave it at that. I have more written comments about our specific concerns, but the cost concern for counties is, when the moratorium and bed closure piece went into effect over the past couple of years, it left a distribution of 24-hour residential beds that doesn't work across the state. It locked us in with certain beds in certain places, and there are still counties who have a shortage of these beds and need access to more beds. And so we're concerned with any policy direction that moves toward closure without giving us an opportunity to address what we would do with those folks, because the only other option we have now is an RTC, and that's the most expensive option for both the state, the county, and it's likely the least desirable option for our consumers. So we do need 24-hour beds. We have concerns in some parts of the state.
I appreciate that, and I wish I had more time to ask questions. Do you have an opinion about what percentage of a non-4-unit place would make sense?
I do not have an opinion on it, but I'd be happy to talk to people who are more educated than
I'm not asking about you, but does your group have if they could develop an opinion, it'd be interesting to hear it.
I'd be happy to get back to you as this is laid over and brought together with some of the other bills, and we move forward.
One more question. Should this become law? And who knows?
Mm-hmm.
You know? But if it were law and the county were in a position to move somebody out because that was they were going to a more suitable site for them, mm-hmm. Would it be true that the county would consider all the factors before they did that, the group that's in there mm-hmm. and the funding? I know when you struggle all the time when you have to have a vacant bed and you need one and you want to move
yep.
somebody. But that's quite a deliberative process, isn't
it? Of course it is, Mr. Chair, and we would. And in fact, part of the accommodation that ARM made in the amendment to Section 12 was recognizing the work we have to do in that area and providing us with some resources so that we have the capacity to do that work. And that would be helpful.
Okay.
Well, so with that, I'll continue to talk to the author and all of you offline as we move forward toward a solution.
Well, thank you for your succinctness. And the last witness, and I only have a minute and a half for you, I'm sorry, Dr. Zuspan, is it? Zuspan, I'm sorry. We have to. There's an amendment coming up as well. That's why I have to.
Hello, my name is Kathy Zuspan. This is my first time to come here, and I must say I'm disappointed. The people on the other side of the issue were given quite a bit of time to talk, and I'm given a minute and a half for what is a very important issue. And yes, I took time out of my busy schedule to come down here because it is important. This is a bill that is pro-provider, written by the providers for the providers. There was no input from the families or the residents that are going to be affected by this bill. And if we rush this through, it means that we really aren't looking at their needs. We're looking at, well, can we help the providers out, but we don't really care about the residents. I know I only have a minute and a half, so let's scoot on real quickly. Fear is a big factor in this process. There are an awful lot of people who are going to be affected by what you do, and they're afraid to come forward. There are very few people here today to back this because everyone's afraid. If I speak out, my family member's going to get the short end of the stick on this. My family member won't get funded. They won't get enough funds. They won't get a placement. They'll get moved, and I'll have no say in it. Fear is huge in this. There are people that are afraid to speak out because they're afraid. And that's a really sad situation in this state. And we need to take some of the fear out of it. And we can do that by giving families and residents some input and not putting it all in the hands of a select group of providers who were given special power just by the fact a moratorium was put down 8 years ago. I'm disappointed that a bill like this came forward. I hope that you'll rethink it. It should not go forward. I know my time's up. I'm truly sad that you did not let Alice Holbert speak. She is a person with a lot of knowledge about this. She has a son that is disabled and that is in a group home, and she has a powerful voice you should hear. I'm sorry you won't take the time for it.
Well, Dr. Zuspan, do you have a family member? Zuspan, I'm sorry. Do you have a family member?
No. I'm an obstetrical anesthesiologist. I'm involved with delivering some of these babies that end up in group homes. I'm there in the delivery room when these little tiny babies come out and end up with disabilities. We are making more and more children that are going to be needing these group homes. We can't keep cutting things. We're going to need to be funding them more because in the future, these 24, 25, 26-weekers are surviving with severe disabilities, and we're going to need to be thinking of this problem and getting some solutions now because there's going to be an awful lot of kids for this in the future.
Thank you, Dr. Zuspan. Representative Lomer, your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norman.
Wait, we have to actually adopt the A2 amendment. Let's vote on that first. Everybody understands that this is being held over. So this is the third committee. This is being discussed today. It'll be discussed again. All in favor of the A2 amendment as amended, say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. Representative Lomer moves the A3 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Norton and I have been working a lot on autism issues this year, so this amendment that we're offering, the A3 amendment, actually directs the commissioner to develop an optional certification for providers of home and community-based services that demonstrate competency in working with individuals with autism. So that's my amendment.
And I know it's a work in progress, and I know you're talking to the department. Representative Liebling, to the amendment.
Thank you. To the amendment, Mr. Chair, thank you. And I just wanted to support the amendment. I know that this is very important to the autism community. Obviously, there are some you know, we want to make sure that these facilities actually meet the needs of some residents with very special needs.
And I'm only sorry it's put off a ways, so, but I would, maybe we can get this to be quicker in terms of allowing some use. Do you want to say more on that, Representative Lomer? This is being held over for inclusion, and I think the work will continue on this. I'm happy to be a part of that if I can be useful. Representative Lomer?
No, I don't really have anything more to say except I hope we can support the amendment. Thank you.
Okay, let's do that. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It's adopted. Representative Schumacher, Mr. Nelson, I'm sorry we're out of time. If you want to have a final statement, Representative Schumacher, using the word mango in a sentence, that would be appropriate.
I think I've overused my mango allowance for the day. But there, I just did it. So, all right, winner, winner. Thank you for your indulgence today, members of the committee, for the entire day. I really appreciate this and some of the discussions we had. A lot of good questions asked, and I look forward to moving forward on these as we go.
And just let me offer a challenge to the authors, the author and the supporters of this bill. I think that it's important to listen to the concerns expressed by the those who testified against it. Even though we're not having long times, we do listen pretty well, actually, to the voices of the public and not just in this room. And so I would urge the proponents of this to continue to work on that. You heard some concerns from the department. However, we do need to have some relief to the providers so they can stay in business, because without them, we're not going to be able to have good service for the people who absolutely need it into the next 50 years. So this bill is laid over for possible inclusion with some work to be done.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to make a comment in regards to that also, that as I was reading through this bill, noticing some things, that even on the Innovation Task Force, there are quite a few members. Only one is a person receiving disability services or a family member. And so maybe there's some changes that are in there, but I think those family members and other people who do should be given equal concern and hearing to the issues other than the department or another association. Those individual family members do a lot. So I hope you'll give them very strong consideration.
Wayne, we'll take, can you get the last word? We're adjourned. Thank you. Right. Have a nice weekend.